For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host Red Sail, and this week, Scott Kershaw reveals how a spate of dog nappings inspired his chilling, high-concept thriller, The Game. Femi Kayode transports us to Nigeria for his tense thriller, Lightseekers. And CJ Tudor tells us how an innocent game with her daughter morphed into her deliciously creepy debut, The Chalk Man. That's all coming up on today's Read On. A chilling, high-concept thriller has just landed in the RNIB library. The Game, by Scott Kershaw, explores the lengths that ordinary people will go to when faced with the kind of situations usually only found in our worst nightmares, or in video games. That's the basic beta. Now here's the game's creator to take us to the next level.
So the game follows these five unrelated people across the world who in one day all have their loved ones abducted, and all they've got to go off is a series of text messages ordering them to play this mysterious game. The text messages call the shots, and they've got no choice to obey, or else their loved one will presumably be killed. And that's it. It's just these five ordinary people being forced to become investigators of their own mystery, really, and find out why this has happened to them, why they deserve this to happen, and all the while fighting against a ticking clock and trying to figure out who's telling the truth in the situation.
And that ticking clock really adds a level of tension throughout the book. We know that game over is coming, and it's just watching how each of these five people react. And you tell the story from the point of view of each of those characters, and you give us some background to their situations, but really, this is a book that gets the reader to think, well, how would I react in that position? What would I do?
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, part of the fun of writing it and part of the whole idea generation behind it is I really wanted to play a game with the audience as well. I did it with everything in the way that it's written, the actual prose on the page. I really wanted to translate the feeling and the panic. So it's written in a really short, fast way, even though a lot of the time there's quite mundane things happening. I wanted it to be kind of grounded in reality and make the reader really question, yeah, if this happened to me, what would I do? And it gets progressively worse, obviously, as it goes along. At first, it's being a certain place at a certain time. And as it goes along, you start to get pushed into worse situations, I guess.
Yeah, it is the ultimate coercive relationship, isn't it? Your characters do not have a choice. If you don't do it, you lose your loved one. And that's what's so chilling about it, because as you say, you ground it in day-to-day life. And as a reader, we think, well, that actually could happen.
Yeah, that's it. When I was growing up, in my teenage years, was when there was the horror craze of what they called torture films, like the Saw franchise and all the Death Game movies, like Hostel and stuff. And I always watched them and thought, well, you know, who's making these crazy elaborate traps and giant machines? And what if you just stripped it completely down? And how much can you do with just a phone and taking someone that someone loves? That's it. That's all you need to do. And you can get them to do pretty much anything.
Yeah, I was also reminded of things like Saw and more recently Squid Game, although this book isn't quite as gory as those series. But I was also reminded of those books that I had as a kid in, I guess, the 1980s, where you were asked to make a decision, and depending on that decision, you turned to page 15 or page 35. And yeah. So you were in charge of your own destiny through the book.
Yeah, man. I got given some of them when I was a kid from my uncle, who also had, and they were really big in when he was growing up in the 80s. And yeah, I always liked that. If I had it my way, I would have liked to have maybe another one of them one day, but I don't know if it will sell. But yeah, that's it. It's that kind of idea that all these characters are really flawed people. Every single character is hiding something and they have to make a choice. And yeah, it'll either lead them further into the labyrinth as they used to be in the books,
You said the inspiration came from those series like The Saw, but that concept of the text dropping onto your phone one day, was that an idea that just came to you out of the blue, or did you sit down and plot this out for months and months and months before you started writing it?
No, I just kind of started writing it. It was literally, I had this image of someone being taken, and I started talking to people, like, just in general conversation, we were talking, how far would you actually go? And this question people always think, you know, as you start to get loved ones, as you get older, I've just got married and stuff, and you start to lay there at night in the dark sometimes, and you're like, God, what would I actually do to get you back? And this sounds really stupid, but at the time, it was in lockdown, and there was a lot of dog nappings, and I have a dog, and people were going across the country and stealing dogs, and you saw in the news people offering huge rewards to find them, and that kind of mixed into it. And I was thinking, God, if someone stole my beagle and that's just a dog, what would you do if it was your kid? Terrible answer.
That's a novel way into a plot. And actually, you've got quite an unusual backstory as a writer yourself. As you say, as a product of the dive bars of Grimsby, you might not necessarily have the literary background that some of your contemporary authors might have.
No, not at all. Which hasn't been a major setback. At first, I thought it would be. But no, yeah, I'm a pretty normal guy. I grew up on an estate in Grimsby. Yeah, at first I thought that'd be challenging. I didn't have any real GCSEs when I was school or any college education or anything. And I did it all later in my 20s. I went back and did uni and stuff. And that, I don't know if it necessarily made a big impact on writing a book in terms of, you don't need qualifications to write a book. But it certainly just got me back in the mindset and got me used to criticism and editing. And so I'd recommend it to people to just stay in the loop of writing. But I don't think a degree is necessary in becoming a writer.
Have you always written down your ideas? Have you always played with stories in your head?
Yeah, I loved writing and reading since being tiny. Literally since watching Sesame Street when I was a kid and learning the alphabet, that was it. And my mum, she was a single mum at 23 with twins. She always took the time to buy us books. This was like the early 90s, so it was always Roald Dahl books or Goosebumps books. And then that progressed to The Hobbit and stuff. And that was it, yeah. I was just hooked from really, really young. And then in school, I always wrote short stories. And she used to get dragged into parents' evenings because they were concerned about the things I was writing. It's true, they used to always drag her in. So yeah, I guess I've always wanted to do it. But life as a teenager, it didn't really work out. I wasn't a great kid. So it was years later, like I said, in my early 20s, I was working terrible jobs and I was just like, I need to do something else with my life because it's going to drive me crazy.
And I believe some of your early writing found its way onto the desk of a creative writing professor at Hull University.
Yeah, so that's how I got a degree. So I didn't have any qualifications. And Labour used to run a scheme called Connections, especially in the Northeast. So they had an office in Grimsby and they used to track down kids after school who basically should have done well and then, I guess, struggled at the end or whatever. And they got in touch when I was maybe 19 and just said, hey, do you want to come in and talk to us? And I was working outside a bar at the time. I used to have to just clean the patrons' vomit out of bins every morning. That was my job. And they offered me to go in for a chat. I went in and they said, hey, you know, we looked back through your grades. We saw that you were good at English and got no marks and anything else, because even though you were predicted them, would you like to try and do a journalism? I think it was just a diploma or something. So I went for a couple of weeks, and while I was there, obviously I had to write a couple of articles, and they somehow got passed along around the tutors, and yeah, ended up on, I don't know what you call it, the coordinator of the university program, basically. And he just said, yeah, if you come on, you don't need to do the UCAS way. I'll take you on based on this, but you need to work hard for me. And that was it. That's how I got onto the degree.
And it's clearly paid off. The Game is your debut novel as a sole author, but I believe that in 2019 you co-wrote a book called Beyond Reasonable Doubt, which was very highly praised by the Crime Writers Association and has also been optioned by the BBC. Could you tell us a little bit more about that, please?
Yeah, sure. So I first started writing, I wrote a book 10 years ago now that didn't sell. That was called Animus, but that managed to get me a great agent called Rory. He stayed in my contacts for years, and then a few years later, I got in touch with him again. I said I was thinking of working on another book, and he suggested that I meet up with this barrister that he'd met, and he said he has great stories, called Gary Bell. He's Queen's Counsel. He has amazing crime stories, but he just needs someone to help put it into words, and we think you could really help him out and help each other out. And I really didn't think that would be for me because it sounded like not my cup of tea, put it that way. He was a barrister and a very fancy guy in a horsehair wig. And I went and met him, though, and we just got on great, me and Gary. And, yeah, we ended up writing Beyond Reasonable Doubt, which was the first of two books, and Bloomsbury bought Beyond Reasonable Doubt and Postmortem. And, yeah, they got optioned by the BBC, and they were very much Gary's baby, you know, his name on it, but we had a great time writing them together, and that in turn then got me noticed enough to get the Game published, I guess.
Since we're talking about TV, the Game, it will make either a brilliant film or TV miniseries. You write very visually, and I was wondering if you had any actors in mind for the characters who you put through the mill in the plot of the Game.
Oh man, that is a good question. And no, I feel like when I was writing it, I distinctly remember I used to pitch people in my head, and I can't even remember who now because my memory is terrible. But that is a good question. I'm going to think on that. And hopefully one day that'll actually be something someone will ask me, but we'll see.
Well, we'll keep our fingers crossed. In the meantime, we have the audiobook version to enjoy as well as the paperback, and It is brilliantly narrated by Ethan Kelly. Did he have the kind of voice that you'd heard in your head whilst you were writing the book?
It's a tricky one because I listen to a lot of audiobooks because I'm currently renovating a terrible, dilapidated house. So while I'm doing it, I listen to books all day. And when I actually heard my own book read back, it kind of freaks me out a bit. Like, I find it very weird because until that point you've only heard those sentences in your own head, if that makes sense, and then it's like someone dipping into your head and reading. It's a very strange experience the first time you hear it. But yeah, we wanted someone with a voice that could jump between the five characters and stay distant enough, and yeah, I think that kind of nails it.
Tears finally come as she hurries back inside for paper towels. All she needs now is for the cops to find her mopping up blood by the rubbish chute. Way to go, Maggie. Whoever said you were irresponsible? She checks her phone before making it to the kitchenette to see how many minutes have passed. Only now does she pay attention to the notification on screen. She opens the text message, stopping dead, and reads. It isn't long, but it takes her a while, as if the words are composed of another language altogether. They aren't. Concise, clear, cutting, their simplicity is chilling. She gets to the end and starts again, twice. There's a photograph attached. She downloads the image. It's hard to take in. She drops to her knees. She is surely having a heart attack.
Ethan Kelly narrating The Game, written by my guest, Scott Kershaw. And you say you're a fan of audiobooks. What have you been listening as you've been filling the cracks and painting the ceiling then?
Well, in the first lockdown, I set myself a challenge because when I was a kid, I was mad on Stephen King. So in the first lockdown, I set myself a challenge that during lockdown, I'd read every Stephen King published novel and short story, which was a pretty tall order and obviously did not get done. So I've been working through every single Stephen King book for the last year now, pretty much. You know, people give him a lot of stick in proper literature circles and stuff, but yeah, he's just a great storyteller. He's is what you should aspire to if you want to sell books, I guess.
As a high concept thriller author, are you a fan of other authors like Stuart Turton, for instance, who write these incredibly complicated, almost computer game like novels?
No, I'm going to embarrass myself now and say that I very rarely read new books. This is like something I'm really trying to get into the habit of now, because obviously now my life's starting to shift towards being in the world of new books and authors. And so no, I've been really terrible. I've been like the music fan who still, well, I am the music fan who still listens to everything pre-1999. And I guess, yeah, I need to really sort myself out when it comes to being a reader now that I'm sorting myself out being a writer.
Yeah, you've got to go and check out the competition.
Yeah.
I obviously can't see the cover of the game, but I've been told I need to ask you to describe it for me and the listeners.
Okay, so it's a very stark, simple cover. We just wanted one kind of iconic image that you could spot from a distance. And it is a silhouette of a person hanging from marionette puppet strings. So it's like a very crisp, graphic, what unfortunately is a dead body, I guess, hanging from marionette strings. And that's it. It's just very bold. We went for bright orange because that's my favourite colour, probably because I'm ginger.
Well, I expect that very striking cover is going to be emerging from many people's pockets and backpacks over the months to come. And there'll be a little sea of orange on plains and beaches across Europe. Scott Kershaw, thank you so much for taking us further into the chilling world of the game. And I hope you'll come back at the end of the show to share the books of your life.
Absolutely. I'd love to. Thank you, Rick.
Thanks to the generous support of publisher HarperCollins, The Game by Scott Kershaw is available from the RNIB Library. And Scott will be back at the end of the show to share the books of his life. You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, CJ Tudor shares her delight at discovering that Stephen King is a fan of her work. But first, Femi Koyode has published his debut novel, Lightseekers, a slice of Nigerian noir that follows a forensic psychologist as he investigates the lynching of three students in a remote town in Nigeria. He joined Read On producer Hannah Taus from his home in Namibia to discuss being an outsider in one's own country, the mindset of mob violence, and the impact of Nigerian fiction.
Femi Koyode, welcome to Read On.
Thank you for having me.
So, can you give us a bit of an introduction to Lightseekers?
Lightseekers is basically inspired by a series of very real life situations that some sort of happens a bit too frequently in Nigeria. But in this particular case, it's inspired by the lynching and burning alive of four undergraduate students in the southern part of Nigeria. And what I did with the novel was to create a fictional character who is an investigative psychologist and has been given the task of finding out why, in the case of the book, three students are burnt alive by these villagers in this university town. And his journey just sort of takes him through interviewing people, finding out what led to the lynching, how did it happen, and all that. And I think in the process, we get to meet very, very interesting characters. We get to find out what makes people tick, why are people so afraid. And so there are a lot of sociological issues that are brought up in the story that's just supposed to create a certain level of complexity and to give maybe the reader a closer insight into why things are the way they are in Nigeria.
As you say, your protagonist, Philip Taiwo, is a psychologist rather than a detective. Now,
yes.
You also have a background in clinical psychology. So is that why you decided to write a why done it rather than a traditional who done it?
I think so, yeah, definitely. Although I did train as a clinical psychologist, I never really practiced because I realized very early on, as soon as I left school and I did start my PhD, I realized that this was not for me. Every time when I was in therapy or I was in class, I found that I was constantly daydreaming about the other possibilities of what the story really is, kind of thing. So I realized that I was not going to be any great help to my patients if I did take the clinical psychology route. I like the fantasy and I like to create the stories behind the story. But coming back to Light Seekers, I think the real issue was that I had a personal vested interest in why this kind of crime happens in Nigeria, that in why people would do this to another human being. And I didn't have any answers. And I felt like if I was able to create a character that would ask the same kind of questions that I would ask, it would really, really help me to almost navigate my conflict about my homeland and about my people, in a sense. And so I think it was a no-brainer for me to use a psychologist. So I think even if I did not study psychology, I would have still used somebody of that inclination, so to speak, as my protagonist.
Part of Philip's background is that he spent years living in America, and he obviously feels quite out of place back in Nigeria. And in a way, his ability to get to the truth seems to be hampered by having quite a Western psyche. Now, you've moved around quite a lot. Nigeria, UK, the US, you're in Namibia now.
Yeah.
Do you suffer from that same sort of disconnection, as it were, to how life is in Nigeria?
Yes, I do. Absolutely. And I think that is one of the reasons why I totally identify with Philip Taiwo. Because when you've been away for so long and you've lived in many different societies and communities, you do come home with a different set of eyes. And sometimes we can be a bit patronizing. We can sometimes be almost like we have some kind of a superiority complex because we've seen things that others haven't seen, and we become a bit more judgmental in a way. And so what I wanted to do was also to walk through some of my conflicted feelings about Nigeria. And the more I did that, the more I was able to realize that at the end of the day, we are all just humans, and circumstances and the society and the community and a lot of factors contribute to where we are today. It can be political, it can be sociological, it can be psychological, but there are just so many things that contribute to why we are the way we are, whether we're in the UK, whether it's because of Brexit, whether it's because of Meghan Markle and Harry in the US, whether it's because of Twitter wars and filibusters. You know, there are just so many reasons that contribute to why people become the way they are. But at the end of it, at the essence of it, is that we all react similarly when confronted with similar factors, similar influences, so to speak. And for me, that was a very liberating experience, just journeying through writing the book and getting to the point where you can say, we are all humans. So yeah, I think for me, it was very, very important for me to have a character like Philip that would ask those questions. And he was sort of like my eyes, in a sense, and my heart, in a sense.
Talking about Nigeria, it's very much a character all of its own in the novel. Some of the subjects that you bring up include corruption, the mob violence, of course, and particularly the confraternities and universities.
Mm.
And this is in really stark contrast to the very strong sense of morality that Philip has, the desperation of the victim's father to find the truth, and the unexpected assistance of some of the characters. Would you say that that kind of reflects Nigerian society as a whole, both the good and the brutally bad?
Oh, that's such an interesting question. And the only way I can answer it is, it's something that came up once. And somebody went to Nigeria and landed at the airport, a European, and he was apparently robbed at the airport. And he had no passport, he had no bags, and he was just like literally robbed. And as he stood outside the airport, in less than 5 minutes of stating his case to a couple of onlookers, somebody was like, oh, get in the car, get in the car. And somebody took him to their house and, you know, they took care of him. And they're like, no, don't worry, we're going to take care of you. They took him to the embassy and they took care of him without asking for anything. And he always tells that story about how complex the community or the society is. That on the one hand, he was robbed. And in the same hand, he experienced the highest level of kindness, human kindness that you could ever ask for. And so that complexity is really what Light Seekers is about. They are good people and they are bad people, and they are corrupt people and they are honest people. They are people with integrity and they are people without integrity. And again, it goes back to exactly what it is. It's just humanity in all its complexity. So for me, that question that you just asked me is just so insightful, because that is exactly what the book is about. It's supposed to actually present the country or the society in a much more three-dimensional way than you would see in the media or that you read in books. I didn't want to tell a single story. I really wanted to tell a multifaceted story about a very complex community. I can't even say a complex country, but more of a complex people.
Now, Philip has a sidekick, Chica, who is far more than just the driver that he's introduced as originally. He's just meant to be there to be helping him out. And Chica and Philip have quite a complex relationship. It's full of secrets, and yet it's surprisingly intimate as well in some ways. How much did you enjoy writing that particular relationship?
It was the most fun. It was really the most fun. I think I've always been interested in something that I actually have not really experienced in most of my travels, and that is a genuine friendship between men. I've been in situations where you're friends with people at different levels. You know, there's your drinking friend, and then there's your family friend, and there's your work friend, you know. So there's all this categorization of the type of friends. Or maybe because I've always been a foreigner, so I've always fallen into a category of friendship in the different places that I've lived. But in Nigeria, that was what I missed the most, the completeness of friendship. You don't go drinking with your friend and you don't discuss politics and you don't discuss your marital woes and you don't discuss your family and you discuss everything. It's a 360 relationship. And I really wanted to explore that because I missed it a lot in all my travels. I missed a lot of my friends and that kind of relationship. And so I think Philip and Chika's relationship was very, very dear to me. But to be honest, in terms of all of Light Seekers, the parts that I enjoyed writing the most were the relationships between husband and wife, between friends, between, you can even say, boss and employee, the relationships between the chief and the villagers, you know. So I think that's the psychologist in me. I really love writing about relationships and the dynamics of relationships and the levels that we tend to approach these relationships. And somebody once told me that one of the things that they love most about Light Seekers is the relationship between fathers and sons. And I think that's also something that really comes across as a theme. It really is about relationships. Yeah.
The story is inspired by the real life necklace killings back in 2012 of the Alufor, is it? Which was also in Port Harcourt, where most of the book is set. How much of the book is a fictionalized account of that sort of mob violence, and how much of it is based on real facts?
To be honest, I really wanted to be as close to the facts as possible while I was writing the book, and I would get stuck. And I think there was a part of me that had this wall that really refused to believe, and I could not write convincingly about the facts because I couldn't understand it. And I really only felt completely liberated when I went purely into the realm of fiction. So I would read the facts and I'll say, what if it happened differently? What if that's not what actually happened, kind of thing. So I would say the only thing that is a bit real, the only fact there, is that it happened in Port Harcourt. But every other thing, including the university, the names, the village, everything was changed completely. I only found true freedom when I went in the purely fictionalized space. So I can't say that there's any fact beyond the fact that Alufor happened. It's interesting because I did do a lot of research, and I was inspired by Capote's In Cold Blood, which was based on another crime in the United States then. And I kept on thinking to myself, I don't know whether I wanted to profit from such misery And the more I thought about it, the more I became determined to deviate from the facts as much as possible. I think the week I finished the book was the day the trial of the Alufo was over and they sentenced, I think, four of the accused to death. But I could see the pain on the parents' face. It was such an unfinished business. And I didn't think I wanted to be part of that.
Now, Nigerian literature has become very popular over the last few years in the West. What do you think accounts for this rise in interest at the moment?
What is really becoming very fascinating is the interest in Nigerian crime fiction.
The Nigerian noir.
Yeah, the Nigerian noir, or like my friend Leia Dinlis calls sunshine noir, you know.
you know, I think I prefer that term.
I love sunshine noir because, you know, in that you can feel the heat and you can feel the smiles of the people and the energy of the people and you can feel the music and so much. But to your question, I think the reason is because it's very multifaceted. There's an idea that one in every four Black person is a Nigerian. And there is literally no corner of the world that you go to that there's no Nigerian. So that actually says something. People are interested in this. The real issue is that I think there's a phenomenal rise across board of Nigerian creativity. So I think there's a fascination about this group of people and the fact that people are interested in trying to find out what makes them tick, for good or for bad. And the fact that, you know what, let's call a spade, they do write well. They really are good writers. They're really good storytellers. And I think people are interested in that. And I really am very proud of the fact that I'm coming onto the stage around this time when so much work has been done in the past by the Ben Okris of this world, even by Onyeka's My Sister, the Serial Killer. You know, just knowing that there's so many people that have done all the hard work in the past to open the gates for this interest to be stimulated, so to speak. It's a phenomenal group of people that's everywhere. They're talented, they're medical doctors, they're pastors in mega churches, they're criminals and they're kind people, they're charitable people. So everybody's curious about them and they have really talented people. I think the market will go where the audience is.
The audiobook opens up your literature to those who are print disabled. How much involvement did you have in the recording? And did you get to choose the narrator yourself?
Yes, I did, actually. I think the audiobook, especially in the US, they sent me this wide array of voices and they told me to choose. I said, okay, give me a couple of days, then I will put the names into Google and then I will throw the voices on social media, just, you know, just try to get a sense of who they were as people, not just as readers, so to speak, or performers. It's a very complex role to cast because Philip has not lived in Nigeria for almost 20 years. So he has an American accent. He has to speak in a particular way for us to understand the fact that he's not American. So it was very difficult to cast. So that took us a long time. But I did get involved in the production. It was very, very exciting and it was very detailed. So I liked the outcome a lot. He didn't have to act. He really just was.
Truth is, the hurried way I packed my bags and left home in the early hours of this morning had little to do with punctuality and everything to do with my unwillingness to ask my wife the question that was uppermost in my mind. Are you having an affair? It had taken a lot of willpower to tamp down that question this morning as Folake stood in her light cotton housecoat, arms akimbo. Her long locks were pulled back from her face, so there was no masking her disapproval as she watched me pack. You're really doing this? Yes, I grunted, and made a show of counting some underpants. And it doesn't matter that I think it's a bad idea. I placed boxes in my suitcase and responded in what I hoped was a well-crafted, neutral voice. We've been through this, Folake. You're not a detective, Philip. She stressed my name in the way she does when she's trying, unsuccessfully, to hold on to her patience.
Kerry Height, narrating Light Seekers, written by my guest, Femi Kayode.
Femi Kayode, thank you so much for joining us on Read On, and we look forward to hearing all about your next book when it's published.
Thanks, Hannah. Light Seekers by Femi Kayode is narrated by Carey Height and available commercially. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we return to Scott Kershaw to hear the books of his life, C.J. Tudor's debut novel, The Chalk Man, was an international bestseller that drew praise from fans and fellow authors alike, including Stephen King. A deliciously creepy thriller set on the outskirts of an English town. It established C.J. Tudor as one to watch. And, judging by the first few chapters of her follow-up, The Taking of Annie Thorne, she's done it again. It's got me hooked and checking the doors and windows before I go to bed.
Never go back. That's what people always tell you. Things will have changed. They won't be the way you remembered. Leave the past in the past. Of course, the last one is easier said than done. The past has a habit of repeating on you, like a bad curry. I don't want to go back, really. There are several things higher up on my wish list, like being eaten alive by rats or line dancing. This is how badly I don't want to see the crap hole I grew up in ever again. But sometimes there is no choice except the wrong choice.
The Taking of Annie Thorne, narrated by Richard Armitage and written by my guest today, C.J. Tudor. C.J. Tudor, welcome to Read On.
Hello, thank you for having me.
So, before we come on to talk about Annie Thorne, I'd just like to take you back to before the publication of The Chalk Man, because the story about that is just every bit as good as fiction. Tell us about the inspiration for The Chalk Man and where it came in your sort of writing career.
Right, well, I mean, basically, like a lot of debut authors, I've actually been writing for probably over 10 years, sort of trying to get somewhere. And I've got close, and I've had a lot of rejections, and then I sort of get a bit closer and then have some more rejections. And I've got to a point, in fact, a lot of writers get to, where you know you've got something, you know you're not bad, you're not terrible, but you're at that point of thinking, am I ever going to get that break? Am I ever going to just get to that next level? And particularly at that time, I'd had my little girl, she was 2, I was running a dog walking business at the time, traipsing around muddy fields with dogs for, 6-7 hours a day. So time was quite short to fit in the writing with everything else. And I think I have got to that point of thinking, maybe this might just have to remain a hobby. Maybe I'm not going to get that break, but, life is good in other ways, and I'll still enjoy writing. And then someone gave my little girl a tub of coloured chalk for her second birthday. And as you do, we went outside and we started drawing on the driveway, and we did, the flowers and the rainbows and things. And then my little girl wanted to draw stick men. And so we covered the driveway in these kind of multicoloured stick men doing various weird things. And I just went inside and kind of forgot about them. And then later that night, I opened the back door to let our dog out, and the security light came on. And it illuminated these weird chalk figures all over the driveway. And what seemed really innocent in the daytime, suddenly, in the darkness, looked incredibly sinister. I actually jumped. I was like, oh, my Jesus, what the hell is that? Because it was as though they just appeared there, so I'd completely forgotten they were there. And I actually remember I called my partner and went, these chalk men look really creepy in the dark. And it really was one of those light bulb moments. There was sort of a bing, and I was like, chalk men could do something with that. And I started writing it the next day. Obviously, the title changed to The Chalk Man somewhere along the line. But the idea of this childhood game that becomes increasingly sinister leapt off the page really right away. And I wrote it really quickly. I wrote it in about 8-9 months, the first draft. I wouldn't say that I knew I had something, because I don't think you ever do. You sometimes write something and think it's good, and it gets randomly rejected. But I did think there was an idea there, so when I did eventually send it off to an agent, I was sort of keeping my fingers crossed, but still very wary of getting my hopes up too much, because I'd been burnt quite a few times before. But when I did get the call, that the first agent, the one I really wanted, loved it. It was amazing, and it kind of went relatively quickly from there on in. But at each stage, I was kind of telling myself not to get my hopes up, because that's what I kind of do. I was like, if well, I've got an agent, but the publishers will probably all reject it. So I wouldn't let myself get too excited along the way. But it was amazing. And then actually, amazingly still, lots of publishers wanted it. And it actually went to auction, which is kind of every writer's dream, really.
And then the icing on the cake, possibly your favourite author of all time, Stephen King, tweeted about it.
I know. When they ask the publisher what it is, I'll say to you, because they approach, you know, other writers asking them, read your book and say nice things if they like it. And obviously at the top of my wish list was Stephen King, because he's my hero. And the Chalk Man was in many ways a homage to Stephen King and all the things that I loved when I was a teenager. Stephen King, creepy movies, things like The Goonies and The Lost Boys, but all that sort of 80s horror and Stephen King stuff that was wrapped up in my teenage years. And then he's been my hero. I've read him since I was 12 when I first picked up a copy of Christine from the library. I am one of his constant readers. I've read everything throughout my life. And when I said that, I thought, well, that will never happen, but he would be my dream person. And then, yeah, I was sat on a train going into London, actually, and I just opened up my Twitter when I probably should have been working, and it was the first tweet that popped up, and I had to check it wasn't a fake account because I didn't believe it. I thought it might be winding me up. But yeah, it was the most amazing thing, the thought that Stephen King had read my book and tweeted about it. And so I sort of replied to him, and I didn't actually expect him to reply back, but he just replied and said, "You rock." But that is it. That is my gravestone. I'm done now. I don't do anything else. Stephen King says I rock. That is the ultimate. It was just awesome. I get a huge grin every time I think about it still. It was just, yeah, the best thing ever. I say the best moment of my life, and then I have to quickly say, apart from having my daughter and meeting my partner.
Now, as you've indicated, the Chalk Man deals with what should be innocent, a childhood game that leads into something very sinister. Eddie, the hero, has to revisit events of 30 years beforehand when he and his bunch of teenage friends have an innocent game, signalling to each other through these chalk men where they're going to meet up, and somebody hijacks that and it leads them to discover a body. And 30 years later, he receives a letter with a single chalk man and events kick off again. The Taking of Annie Thorne is similar kind of territory. Your protagonist comes back to odd goings-on that were never resolved at the time.
Yes.
What leads you to revisit the past like that? It's incredibly atmospheric, and actually I think a lot of us revisit those thoughts at 2 o'clock in the morning in our heads.
Yes.
But not all of us write them down.
With a Chalk Man, obviously I'd always wanted to write something with that particular book, with a gang of kids set in the 80s, because that was very much when I was growing up. And the idea of, I say, revisiting all those fond memories and not so fond memories was something I've thought about doing for a long time. And then I think tying it up with events in the present worked quite well, because again, the characters were a similar age to me. And so it worked quite well in that respect. It was almost in a way, you know, myself revisiting my teenage years and childhood. And in the Chalk Man, I wanted to explore, say, not only those fond memories, but that darker side of childhood as well. Because we do tend to sometimes view our childhood years and school days through the rose tinted glasses. And actually, for a lot of children, it's a really horrible, scary, dark time. If you're bullied, if you're having a bad time at school, it can be absolutely the worst years of your life. And children, as well as being, you know, wonderful, can be incredibly cruel. And I think, you know, you're still finding a moral compass at that age. And that's quite an interesting thing to play with in terms of writing. Because, you know, there are things that I've seen happen in schools and other friends have told me about that have happened, that you think if that happened in the adult world, we'd be getting the police involved here. But it's somehow within schools and childhood, we kind of write it off as think it's just bullying, you know, everyone's got to go through it type of thing. And it can get really quite dark. That was something I wanted to explore. And again, with Annie Thorne, yes, it's a similar thing. I'm going back to this stuff happened when the protagonist was younger. It's not sort of with the Chalk Man, obviously I did it a chapter set in the 80s and then the next chapter set in 2016. So it's not quite that same sort of cutting back and forth between the timelines. But it does center a lot on what happens to Joe, the protagonist, when he was 15, no, that's when his little sister disappeared for 48 hours. And then she came back, but something wasn't quite the same. Something had changed in her, and it's what happened to her. And it's set in a small mining village in the north of England. I went to school in a small mining village in the north of England, strangely enough. So it draws very much upon my time, sort of at senior school. It's a Chalk Man was just before that time. This almost is a little bit about me writing about things that I remembered from the senior school, because I say it was a school in a small mining village, and I set this particularly during the miners' strike parts of it, because again, I was at school during that period, and I think that idea of the industry dying, things dying, whether stuff can ever be brought back, was very much a theme of the book. because obviously we rejoin Joe later when he comes back to the village, and it's very much the heart's been ripped out of it, the mines are closed. It's a very grim place that's never really recovered from what happened then, in the same way that Joe's never really recovered from what happened with his little sister and all the other events when he was a teenager. So yeah, I think it's fun to play with those ideas. I think a lot of us sometimes have that, oh, you know, I wonder what happened to that person from school. I wonder, revisiting those old friends and you haven't seen them in years can be an interesting experience.
And I suppose also it's when the good turns to bad, when the rot sets in.
Yeah.
Both books start with quite violent events, which I think, whilst The Chalk Man, it doesn't venture into the supernatural, there's definitely a sense of a release of potential energy that starts bad things happening. Are you grounded in when natural things could be interpreted as supernatural, or are you drawn to a sort of more spiritual dark side, as Stephen King is sometimes?
I like playing with both, actually. I think in The Chalk Man, although there were undertones that there could be something perhaps supernatural going on here, who's leading these chalk drawings, how they appeared, and obviously there's some sequences with the main protagonist where we weren't sure and he isn't sure what's real and what's not real, actually. But I think in The Chalk Man, we have all our answers, but very much in real life. It's more about people and the consequences of people's actions rather than some supernatural bogeyman. I think in The Taking of Annie Thorne, I venture a little bit more in supernatural territory. That shouldn't scare anybody. It's very much a mystery still. Mm. And I think you can interpret it in any way you want to be fair, in some regards, again, because I do leave some questions a little bit open to interpretation, which I deliberately wanted to do. But, you know, most of your answers to the mysteries are, again, they're there in people's actions. There is no, what I call, the kind of the Scooby-Doo ending. There's no cop-out where, oh, my God, it was the monster that did it. I don't like those endings. I like to have things resolved in real life. This is what happened, and this is why it happened, and it's a consequence of what someone did here. So I like to have pretty much all those answers there so people don't feel cheated, because you should never cheat your reader. Even if you're playing with something a little bit more out of the natural realm or supernatural. I hate using the word supernatural in some regards because it just makes you think of ghosts and ghouls and werewolves and vampires, and that's not really what I write. But I do like to have this slightly darker, creepier edge of some things that perhaps aren't entirely explained, and it leans towards that a little bit more in Annie Thorne. But it is primarily very much a mystery, and I hope the answers are satisfactory to everybody at the end.
Well, so far I'm finding it a mystery laden with dread.
Well, that's good too.
And I wondered what scares you.
Oh, God, everything. I think actually you can't write creepy, scary stuff unless you have a healthy amount of fear yourself, because you're often playing upon your own fears, really. I say, you know, if someone says, what's the worst that can happen? I can tell them in great detail. I just, you know, just even silly things that, even though I'm like 47 years old now, I still have that fear of going out into the dark, of something coming around the corner, or something being just behind me, or the hand on my shoulder. I used to live in a little terrace house at one point, and it had a cellar, as a lot of little terrace houses do, and the door to the cellar was in the living room, but it didn't lock, and it didn't quite shut properly. There was this little sliver of darkness. Every night I used to stare at that door partially open. I used to hate going down there anyway, because there's just something about it that was creepy. Eventually, I couldn't live with it. I just always imagined a hand creeping around the door, and I had to put a bookcase in front of it eventually. And I think it's that part of your imagination that works really well if you like writing creepy or scary stuff. You still maintain that almost childlike fear of things coming out of the dark, or just stupid fears of what could happen. I was on an aeroplane the other day, and I was in the wrong seat. I checked it wrong, and I'd got on the wrong side of the plane. And a woman came on and said, oh, no, don't worry. It's basically the seats are the same. I'll sit the other side. It doesn't matter. Then immediately my morbid mind started thinking, yes, but what if the plane crashed and only one of us survived because we swapped seats? And so I think it's that macabre imagination that you just can't help thinking these things.
And did you have much to do with the selection of the narrators for the audiobooks?
I didn't, actually. No, both times they said to me, this is who we're thinking of. And both times I just went, oh, yes, that's perfect. Because I think I've been very lucky in the choice. So obviously we had Andrew Scott. Ashley Butterfield, yeah, who voiced the Chalk Man. Obviously, we had to have a young voice and a slightly older voice for that. That was wonderful. Like, we did a marvellous job. And I'm very lucky again. I've got Richard Armitage voicing The Taking of Annie Thorne, who, again, is just absolutely brilliant. I've heard some of it, and I went in for a little bit for the recording. And it's a totally different thing, hearing your words read out. It's a strange thing, actually, because although I used to work in commercial radio, so I used to write those really annoying radio adverts, so I was used to reading stuff aloud, and I very much like, in a way, I still write it, I'm writing spoken words sometimes. I like to keep my writing quite informal. But it's still strange hearing your own words read out like that, I think, when it's a book. And you get inferences and things that you perhaps didn't even quite imagine in your own head, but when someone else reads it, they just give that whole new different light. And I love that. I love hearing it. So I always do, actually, when I've gone twice now to studios, hear some recorders, and I always do have that slight dread that I will hear something and go, oh, no, I wish I'd changed that line. But no, the narrator's just been absolutely marvellous and very lucky.
Also, I know that some authors have heard their audiobook versions and gone, oh my goodness, I've given away who the murderer is because it's being read in a Brummy accent and there's only one Brummy character in the entire book. And I know Mark Billingham has gone back and rewritten some of his books for talking books.
That's perfect, actually. I suppose it's what the internal voice of the nameless killer, and then it's given away. I could have never thought of that, actually. Oh, no, that'd be awful, wouldn't it?
Well, you haven't done it yet, and hopefully you won't do it now.
Fortunately, not yet. I don't think that would happen in anything I've written so far. I was just trying to think about book three now. But no, I think, fortunately, with the construct of the books and the way they're narrated, and obviously the first to the first person, which makes it easier, I think. Yeah, I don't think there's any giveaways yet, but it's made me think that I shall bear that in mind in future.
Well, I've given you something to stay awake at with 2 o'clock in the morning, haven't I? As you've indicated, your protagonists are male, and certainly before looking you up, I didn't know whether CJ stood for Charles James or Caroline Joanne or whatever.
Caroline James, yes.
Was that a conscious decision to go by your initials, or were you asked to by the publishers?
No, obviously a lot of people do, and there are a lot of authors who do choose initials to be gender neutral for people don't know. But actually, no, it was just more along the lines of when I was thinking of what I would submit it under, my full name's Caroline Jane Tudor, so the initials are obviously CJ. And Caroline Tudor, for me, just didn't sound like a creepy crime writer. I don't know, it just sounded a bit too flowery. So everyone called me Kaz, actually, short for Caroline. But again, I thought at the time, oh, Kaz doesn't sound very authorish. I have since met Kaz Freer, who's also an author and a good friend, and it worked for her fine. But at the time, I thought, maybe Kaz isn't an author sort of name. So I just thought I'd plumped my initials. And then the publishers, yeah, they were happy to go with that, really. I didn't think of it in a very sort of publishing way, or didn't think about it in terms of trying to hide whether I was male or female. It just looked right on the page. It was as simple as that, really. But yeah, I suppose it does work because, you know, I do often write in gender opposite. But yeah, it wasn't really a very planned out decision to do that, to try and fool people and make people think. Because it wouldn't work very well anyway, because you flip to the end of the book and see a picture generally. So when people try and do that, it's not as if you can sustain that illusion for very long anyway. So it's kind of pointless, really.
Well, CJ Tudor, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On. The Taking of Annie Thorne and The Chalk Man are available in Braille from the RNIB Library and in audio commercially. Now it's back to Scott Kershaw for the books of his life.
Scott, was there a book that you read as a youngster that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
I'd probably say the big one would have been The Hobbit, first time I read it. I remember absolutely being swept away by that. I was only about maybe seven, and I remember that just being the one where I just sat eating chub chub lollies for days reading it and just being like, this is it, this is how you do it, just create a world that doesn't exist.
Out jumped the goblins. Big goblins, great ugly looking goblins, lots of goblins before you could say rocks and blocks. There were 6 to each dwarf at least, and 2 even for Bilbo, and they were all grabbed and carried through the crack before you could say tinder and flint. But not Gandalf. Bilbo's yell had done that much good. It had wakened him up wide in a splintered second, and when goblins came to grab him, there was a terrific flash like lightning in the cave, a smell like gunpowder, and several of them fell dead. The crack closed with a snap, and Bilbo and the dwarves were on the wrong side of it. Where was Gandalf? Of that, neither they nor the goblins had any idea, and the goblins did not wait to find out. They seized Bilbo and the dwarves and hurried them along. It was deep, deep dark, such as only goblins that have taken to living in the heart of the mountains can see through. The passages there were crossed and tangled in all directions, but the goblins knew their way as well as you do to the nearest post office. And the way went down and down, and it was most horribly stuffy.
Andy Serkis, narrating The Hobbit by J.R.R. Tolkien, which is available from the RNIB library.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
In terms of rereading, the book that I've read the most in my life is probably Jack Kerouac's On the Road. When I was a teenager, it really meant a lot to me. It was the book that kind of reshaped how you could write. And yeah, I guess that's the book I've probably read so many times, and I can always still go back to it. That and Catcher in the Rye, I think they just had such a big impact on my adolescence that I can still just dip back into them, and I still love them.
Remy wore shorts around the shack with a crazy army cap on his head. Leanne went around with her hair up in pin curls. Thus attired, they yelled at each other all week. I never saw so many snarls in all my born days, but on Saturday night, smiling graciously at each other, they took off like a pair of successful Hollywood characters and went on to town. Remy woke me up and saw me coming in the window. His great laugh, one of the greatest laughs in the world, dinned in my ear. Ah, paradise! He comes in through the window. He follows instructions to a T. Where have you been? You're 2 weeks late. He slapped me on the back. He punched Leanne in the ribs. He leaned on the wall and laughed and cried. He pounded the table so you could hear it everywhere in Mill City. And that great long ah resounded around the canyon. Paradise, he screamed. The one and only indispensable paradise.
Matt Dillon, narrating On the Road by Jack Kerouac, which is available from the RNIB library.
And finally, is there a book you've read recently that you'd like to share with the listeners?
I am currently reading The Jigsaw Man by Nadine Messerson, which is from the same publisher as me, and it's just a really, really good crime book. I'm not the biggest crime reader in the world, as I said earlier, but yeah, The Jigsaw Man is a very good, very thrilling book.
The important thing was to stay calm, not to let him see that he was getting to her again. Rob, I don't have time for this. I'm going to be late for work, Henley said, grabbing her car keys from the side table. That's the problem. You never... The sound of the front door slamming shut drowned out the rest of his words, but she knew what they were. You never have time. Your work always comes first. Detective Inspector Angelica Henley looked back at the mid-terraced house with the freshly painted blue door. She wondered, not for the first time, what it said about her, that she was happier dealing with rapists and murderers than her own husband.
Davina Henry, narrating Jigsaw Man by Nadine Matheson, which is available from the RNIB library.
Scott Kershaw, thank you so much for sharing your love of reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show today.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today. But Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can always subscribe to the podcast by searching your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sail, and Robert Kirkwood is at Talking_Books. Thanks to producer Hannah, to all my guests, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.